Alrighty, sound check. Can people hear me? Inside the room, yes. On Zoom, I saw a thumbs up. Great. Alright, so let us begin. Tonight we're going to talk about the Platform Sutra, or the Sutra of Weinang. And how many people here have encountered this before in some way? Okay, so a handful, but not a lot. Okay. So this is, if you were to list the top, six or eight sutras, especially in the Zen tradition, this would be in there. It's a sutra that is written from the point of view of and tells the story of one of our ancestors in China. So it's unlike any of the other sutras. So the vast majority of the things which call themselves sutras are describing events of the Buddha's lifetime and are told from the point of view of someone who watched it happen, Ananda. And so all of that happened, 800 years before the events in this sutra happened. So it's a much later addition to the canon. The person in question is Weinang, or Daikon Enno is how we chant their name on in the morning. They get a clap. So like some of the major ancestors get a little extra recognition on the gong. And Weinang was part of this early period of Zen kind of finding its way into China, and really kind of the culmination of that. Like, this is, people really point to, Bodhidharma is kind of credited with bringing Zen to China, even though it had gotten there several hundred years before him. It wasn't really calling itself Zen. It was Buddhism more generally. It had many different flavors. Weinang is six generations in from Bodhidharma. And at that point, the Zen school was starting to recognize itself as such. And especially from that point on, it was really quite distinct. So it was an important time in sort of establishing this particular method of Buddhist practice in China. And it really spoke the Chinese language. So it was written in Chinese, whereas all the other sutras up to that point had been written in a modified Sanskrit, oral tradition, gradually put into Sanskrit and then translated into the Chinese. And this was originally written in Chinese. And it really spoke to the values that were held at that time in that place. I didn't say in the beginning, but I'd like to say, please interrupt me as frequently as possible. That's going to make this more interesting for both of us. If you have any questions, if you have any ideas, if something didn't quite make sense, or like you want to hear a little more detail on something, just let me know. It's a little bit funny in that it's told in the first person. So I did this, I did that, right? It kind of strikes you. And the other thing which is kind of unique about this sutra is that you can really see there's a storytelling aspect of it. There's a myth-making aspect of it, almost uncharitably, a propagandizing aspect of it, where there's a, you can kind of look back and say, okay, well, there's the sudden and the gradual schools of basically different values in practice, different approaches to what is most important in training. And this is pushing the sudden schools version. And that had, at that time, a lot of political implications. And so this was basically written by Shen Hui, who is an ancestor of Huineng. And in it, part of the story which is told in this is how Huineng kind of went up against Shen Xu, who was kind of the hero of the gradual school. So he was sort of the kind of protagonist-antagonist situation here, and you have the sudden school represented by Huineng, you've got the gradual school represented by Shen Xu, and Huineng decisively wins in Dharma combat. And so that's the story which is told. Historically, it's extremely unlikely that it happened anywhere close to that, but the myth is still interesting. And this is, it tells you just the fact that became the myth, that it tells you something about what was happening at that time and how this was valued, why this was valued. So I think what I want to do now is talk a little bit about what the actual story is, and then we'll go into more of the doctrines. What are the teachings that show up here, and how is that discussed? Okay. So Huineng describes himself as, he's illiterate. His father died when he was young, so his mom and him were very poor. He worked as a woodcutter, and so like serf caste in China, and illiterate, and basically in the barbarian like parts of the country. So. That was his background, not elite. And one day he was at a market trying to sell some kindling for firewood, and he heard someone recite a passage from a sutra, and something opened for him. And he asked the person, "What is this? What can you tell me about this? I need to know more." And he said, "Well, you should really go train under so-and-so." And so, he prepared to do that. He kind of, saved up some, got his mom taken care of, and then walked for a month until he got to this monastery and said, "Okay, I'm here." And the abbot of the place said, "Okay, well, so who are you?" And there was a brief exchange. Well, actually, I'll read that. Basically, the abbot liked him, but he said, you don't fit, right? Like people, if you show up with that much wisdom right now, it's not going to go well for you. And so I'm not acknowledging anything. Like basically go hide, like do the grunt labor. So the abbot says, "You're a native of Kwangtung, a barbarian. How can you expect to be a Buddha?" I replied, "Although there are northerners and southerners, north and south make no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is no different from your holiness physically, is different from your holiness physically, but there is no difference in our Buddha nature." And then Huineng continues, "May I tell your holiness that prajna often rises in my mind. When one does not go astray from one's own essence of mind, one may be called the field of merits. I do not know what work your holiness would ask me to do." And he says, "Go to the stable and speak no more." So basically, like, don't let on that you know this, because it won't go well for you. And so he does that. He cleans out the stables, he works in the kitchen, threshes the rice, and that goes on for 8 months. And at that point, there's The abbot decides that he needs a successor, and he challenges the community. He says, anybody who can compose a verse that speaks to their experience of prajna, whichever verse is the best, they will become my successor. I will give them the robe and bowl. And everybody pretty much says, not it. They just kind of take a step back. The basic thought is that Shen Xu, who is the Shuso at the time, the kind of the chief monk at the monastery, was so far beyond all of the other monks that no one wanted to compete with him. And Shen Xu was beset by doubt. So he didn't want to compose one either. The sutra tells the story of him like trying to go to the abbot's room to give him the verse and then turning away. And that happened like 13 times over 3 days. And he couldn't get it out. He just couldn't speak it. And eventually he decided to just write his understanding, his verse of understanding, on a wall. And so he does that, and everybody's very impressed. And at some point, Hui Ning is passing by. Oh, he's in the kitchen threshing the rice, and he hears someone recite it. And he says, wait a second, what's that? And the person who was walking by says, well, this is verse by Shen Xu, and this is why it's important. And he says, well, take me there. Take me to that wall. And he composes his own verse and has the person write it up on the wall for him. And I'll give you those two verses because this is the important part, one of them. So the first one is from Shen Xu. This is the kind of an expression of the gradual approach. Our body is the Bodhi tree. Bodhi means enlightenment. And our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight. So it's speaking to this continuity of practice, this kind of constancy of effort to bring more awareness to this moment, to prevent the kleshas from arising, to this kind of like slow, gradual approach. It happens because of this, the practice that we are doing. And then Hui Ning's understanding, his stanza reads, there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is void, where can the dust delight? So, speaking to the emptiness aspect, speaking to the absolute of it, that creating the duality of there is dust, there is mirror, both are void. And his experience of he did not put in all these years of practice and meditation and reciting sutras and doing prostrations and all of the practices. He just got it. And so that's his understanding. That's what he's bringing forward, that possibility also exists. Yeah, please.
Is it still very much so that way to enter into monastics that most people, that's not looked upon, that you're not really supposed to know anything, though? Or not that you can know anything, but is it still kind of looked at the same way about to preserve the hierarchy between the
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, actually.
Do people still view it kind of in the same way that it pin you too much?
No. At that time, it was very hard to be educated, and it was seen to be pretty much impossible to do Buddhism if you weren't, literate, because it was a lot of sutra study. Part of what Zen was pushing is the doctrine outside words and letters, so like that it doesn't depend on one's intellectual understanding, it depends on one's practice, on one's actual insight. And so Huineng is kind of an outlier example of that, like taken to the extreme where you've never learned anything, that's what, it's still possible even for him. So it's kind of a way of making that point, that it doesn't depend on scholastic endeavors. Or, ritual endeavors, or time in practice. The insight is available at any point if you have it. Which is challenging, because here we all are, doing practices. Yeah, there's another question over here.
Gradual and the sudden. Oh, hi, this is Martha. I'm just curious about the rivalry between the gradual and the sudden and why there was such a rivalry between the two.
My guess is that the rivalry was exaggerated in this account because it kind of ups Huineng's disciples standing if there was a big rivalry and Huineng won. So it's a little bit of a literary device, I would say. So that's one answer. Another answer is that these are basics. Yes, it's true that this moment can be enlightenment. There's not a separation from a moment of clear understanding that one of us may have, and that Shakyamuni had. Like in that moment, it's the same, and so that's a truth, and that if you only look at that truth, that can kind of warp your perspective of the world, and it's also true that there is so much diligence necessary to keep practice accessible. We have to stay on it. We have to keep pushing into it and finding ways to open those doors and windows further and climb through them. And it's just and if we stop, we backslide. We forget stuff. We self. So that's also true. So both of those currents have been involved in, most contemplative practices forever. And this is here they're kind of being teased apart and kind of caricatured a little bit. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Alice. Anyway, we got questions happening. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Alice. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing this. I know the second poem. Most of the Chinese people, we know how to say that, but I guess I did not know the story, did not know the history, or I did not know the first part. But it's very interesting. Thank you for sharing.
Oh, sure. So, what happens at this point in the story is that the abbot looks at Huineng's poem and says, "Oh, it's crap," and he wipes it out. He takes his slipper off and he wipes it off the wall, and everybody's like, "Oh, I guess okay, never mind," because they were impressed at first, and then. And then he shows up in the kitchen, and they have a little exchange. He basically says, "Is the rice ready? Not is the rice ready or not?" And there's a back and forth, and he taps three times, and Huineng understands that means come to my room in the third watch of the night, which is very, very early morning. And so Huineng gets there, and he says, "Okay, you won. I'm transmitting you. I'm giving you this robe and this bowl as a symbol of the teaching. skedaddle, and he propounds, he gives him a teaching. So he has that one encounter where there's an actual teaching given, and after that he's on his own. And he says, you're gonna have to run for quite some time, and don't try teaching too early. And that's the main part of the story. There's a couple of other little anecdotes, but I think that's the important part, really.
Is it not too long? Can you share what the teaching was?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, seems like it might be important, right? So he reads him the Diamond Sutra. So this is one of the Wisdom Sutras. And there's one line in particular that kind of finished Huineng's enlightenment. So one should use one's mind in such a way that it will be free from any attachment. At that point, I became thoroughly enlightened and realized that all things in the universe are the essence of mind itself. So that was the key sentence there, which is interesting because it's kind of speaking to that, like, steadiness of practice.
Could you say it again?
Yeah. One should use one's mind in such a way that it will be free from any attachment. So the Diamond Sutra is it basically revolves around this question: what should I do with my mind? That's a sutra that where the Buddha is speaking, and the Buddha says a lot. It's a lot of negations, but this is part of it. Free from attachments. That's a Diamond Sutra. Yes. So I want to turn to a couple of the different teachings that seem to matter here. One of them is about this kind of non-separability of delusion and enlightenment. So there's going to be a lot of paradox here. Right, so we kind of have to take the rational mind that wants to kind of draw lines around things and get verbal clarity, and sort of soften that, make that a little squishy or a little more translucent. And if you can do that, this will go a little easier. For an ordinary person is Buddha, and klesha is defilement or passion or it's basically karma acting out, is bodhi or enlightenment. A foolish passing thought makes one an ordinary person, while an enlightened second thought makes one a Buddha. A passing thought that clings to sense objects is klesha, while a second thought that frees one from attachment is bodhi. So there's a momentariness to this that is pushed strongly throughout this sutra. Dogen, who comes around 800 years later, less than that, 600 years later maybe, talks about this as enlightenment within delusion is enlightenment, delusion within enlightenment is delusion. So they're basically saying the same thing. There's How are we doing right now? Question. Yes.
This is Reju. That part that you just read and the indication of momentariness of it, I'm curious about how that works with, like, the story of Wei Ning, like, being in the marketplace and having the sudden enlightenment, and then it doesn't seem momentary, because yeah. Then he walks forever, and then the abbot's like, go hide in the barn, and then he writes the poem without, like, getting additional instruction or things like that.
Yeah. And there's nothing in the story that tells us what his mind state was like in that intervening time. Mm-hmm. But he says that my mind is often in prajna. So there may be that moment of enlightenment, and maybe followed by a moment of delusion. Like, there's a lot of moments in that intervening year, plus or minus. Given that he was able to write that stanza, given that he was able to pass the abbot's questions over time, my guess is that relatively more of them were, you know, less attachment, more bodhi. I'm not assuming that there were only those two specific moments that were called out. This is, like, there are moments where, like, there are enlightenment experiences where the mind takes, in a very direct way, it sees the nature of things. And that can be quite dramatic, but it's not, it is a moment. And it's not, like, that moment may stretch, it may be a week or three, but it's not a continuous state. And there's a lot of, like, karmic pressure to turn that into something more lasting than that. And, you know, so hence this, you know, when the second thought is attachment, that's klesha. Yeah. If we have an enlightenment experience, if we can show, okay, bodhi, nice. Now I want to, like, identify with that. Like, I'm the one who has this. Ah, klesha, like, lost it. So that's, it's quick. Yes. Klesha is translated as defilements, or it's kind of karmic obstructions. It's when attachment is happening. Yeah. Kelsey.
Hi, Kelsey. It does seem, as I'm listening to the idea of gradual enlightenment, seems to imply it's incremental in some form.
Yeah.
Like, if I build on this through actions that produce good karma, I'm a little bit more enlightened, mm-hmm. until gradually then I'm enlightened. And so that seems to be that's kind of defeating, if that's the approach that you're taking, right?
I think part of what this is doing is saying, like, yeah, don't quite fall for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of, like, adding up enlightenment moments.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like, as people are, like, you know, like, we're here, we're putting in this effort to kind of adapt our lives to our understanding of Dharma, and, you know, that's challenging and painful at times, and, you know, it kind of upsets things. there's got to be some, like there's a carrot out there, and often it has something to do with this idea of what enlightenment is or what it might be for us. And so I'm curious, like letting in this teaching of the ephemeralness of that, the momentariness of that, what does that do to that carrot? Any noticing there? Yeah.
It's this is Kakwon. Bro, it's a relief. It's a relief, you know, because like there's not some, or at least I'm not gonna try and third person this. Like I have found myself butting up against a lot of like ideas of putting things on pedestals or imagining that like you know like you have to be this enlightened to ride. Mm-hmm. For those of you on Zoom, I'm making the roller coaster motion. You know, like. You have to hit a certain mark, you know, or you're going to be out on your ear, or it's not going to happen, or whatever. And the idea that it's, you know, that it's fluid, that it's in flux, both feels more real in terms of lived experience, and also is like, there's no room for sort of that judgment to land. There's no space for it to grow.
Great.
Raju again. I kind of don't believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, I do. And like Kakwon said, there's also a sense of relief and like resonance with experience. But I also kind of don't believe it.
Well, we'll do the other side in just a sec.
Okay, great.
I think Thomas had one.
Yeah, I resonated with what Kakwon said. To me, it feels this idea of something as kind of unimaginable and brilliant as like this big enlightenment, big E enlightenment in the distance.
Yeah.
It's too distant almost. I don't know if I could do this practice if that was it. For me, it works better if there are like lots of little baby carrots, you know?
Yeah.
And you pick one up, and then it's like, oh yeah, that's. And you slowly but surely you get a lot more carrots, and that's what keeps me that keeps me going.
And I think that's that, especially at that time, that was part of the appeal of this sutra, is that it kind of humanized the path. And was like, oh yeah, well if he can do it, I can do it. Yeah. So. Flip side, something changes over time. And like we move through lots of different states of mind, and you can still recognize that something's different. So for those of you who have been practicing for a while, or if you know someone who's practiced over a long period of time, like can you recognize that aspect? The microphone just walked out of the room, so you might just have to project for a little bit. I think it's getting new batteries. No one quite wants. Oh yeah.
No, can you say that again?
Sure, sure. So the question is, like speaking to the continuity of it, and that, you know, like there are these two aspects of it. Both of them have truth to it, and the one side, yes, it's ephemeral, and the other side, like if you practice for 10, 20, 30 years, like something's different. Like there are changes that happen, and during that time, you may move through lots of different mind states. You may have lots of different moments of attachment and resentment and doubt and all this, you know, the kleshas may be firing off. And still there's something different. It's not just defined by the fact that, like, I'm in a moment of resentment right now. What else? So what's that extra else?
Well, yeah. To think, I guess, I don't know exactly what it is, but like, I know, yeah, my practice is not the same as it was 10 years ago, 12 years ago, or whatever. Like, and I don't remember what it was like then, but I do when I hear people talk about their experiences of, like, oh my gosh, like, this thing, and I'm just like, oh yeah, I think I used to feel that way sometimes, but like, it just, so much, I don't know, maybe not like so much, maybe there's like a little more distance from mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. or like knowing like it's got, you know, really trusting like that's gotta go away or change or
yeah.
be okay, like regardless of how, whatever it is.
Yeah. Thank you. Just to summarize for the sake of Zoom, that was Christina, and it had to, basically, that there's a greater sense of like less doubt in the process and in, you know, how practice is affecting you. That you don't it's not so obvious what's different, but you can kind of see the like reflections on other people of how I don't do that anymore. Yeah, Martha.
Martha again. The image I had when you were talking about that was of nature and how a river can carve a canyon over time, or there can be an earthquake, which is very sudden, very dramatic, but they uh-huh. both have that impact. And so I keep thinking of the whole talk tonight. I keep thinking of the both and. It's not a, mm-hmm. it's not that it's one or the other. It seems like it's both.
Yeah. I think that's true, and when you're during an earthquake, it's hard to think of anything but the earthquake. Yeah. So whichever one is in front of us, like, it's really obvious. It's really obvious how that is true, and to have the mind be malleable enough to be inclusive. Yeah. Yeah, Jay, and I think then we'll move on to the next one.
My name's Jay. Even in my relatively short time, there's a sense of something deepening.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when I'm actually sitting, there's kind of this deepened, but oops, it's gone away. I got to keep the diligence up. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And so there's kind of both aspects in that. Uh-huh. What I have in my head right now is if I'm thinking of this as not something like a description of an experience of enlightenment, however you understand that, or mm-hmm. however, you know, small e, big e, whatever. But for myself, as kind of reminders or advice, what this would mean for me, mm-hmm. what the sutra would mean or the teachings would mean mm-hmm. for me as reminders or advice, would you have any?
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the ways in which it, you know, serves in that is that, you know, like when we don't have a clear answer for something, we tend to fill it in. We tend to make something up. And this is not one of the wisdom sutras, but it's like wisdom adjacent, in that there's a fair amount of negation in here. There's a fair amount of, like, it's not that. So that particular understanding, that's not it. So yes, we're going to do that. We're going to try to fill in. We're going to, like, make answers so that, like, it takes less energy to hold the question. And this is a this offers reminders of how, like, those answers are provisional, right? Like, that's an aspect. So it's like holding it with more of a question mark, making it more live, more vivid.
So I think what I have coming in is a couple of things. One is maybe a reminder to myself, if you think you can just, like, if I just lay out and jump through the hoops, it's going to come.
Right.
That probably is one of the negations.
Bingo.
And if I think I don't have to lay things out and jump through the hoops, That's also probably one of the negations.
Yeah, that doesn't come across as strongly in this particular sutra, but yes. Yeah, nicely put.
And Dainin had one on Zoom.
Oh, okay, great. Dainin, I think you're up.
Wait. Also, I think that there's an interesting, for the platform sutra, this overlay of the times and places. Huineng is sort of this outsider, you know, kind of the hairy-eyed monk that shows up and hasn't bathed for a while, and they put him in the kitchen, and he's not Tenzo. He's just working in the kitchen. And for a very class-oriented society, I think that's one of the lessons that they're addressing, is that Shen Sui is like the fair-haired inheritor. He's the one who's expected to take over. He's the number one guy. But yet the robe and the bowl are transmitted to this outsider. But at the same time, you almost wonder if there was a story of, and how did you really wind up with this bowl and robe? You know, because he's off and sort of doing his own thing. So it's sort of this reaction against the power structure of the set ways of doing things, the structure of the system. And he's very much the chaos agent.
Yeah.
And I think that is reflected in a lot of the way he approaches, you know, overturning this shibboleth of the expectation.
Yeah, thank you. The reason this is called the Platform Sutra is that that's a reference to the ordination platform, that was something which, if you were ordained at that time, it meant that you were kind of not under government control. And so the government kept a strict control over who could get ordained, because then they were outside of their purview. And so there were only certain ordination platforms that could be used to officially ordain someone. And so so that, you know, speaking to that kind of real, like, structured way that this was done, that Dainin is speaking to there. And Huineng wasn't even ordained until, quite a few years after, the events of the story. He eventually found someone who did ordain him and then immediately asked to be his student, and the story continues from there. So there's a couple of other pieces in this I want to pull forward, and time is happening, so let me jump to those. One of these is the distinction between samadhi and prajna. So there's a chapter on this in here. Samadhi is meditation, and especially concentrated meditation, a kind of, well, that's enough. And then prajna is wisdom, it's insight. It's the kind of understanding things as they are. So this is Huineng speaking. Learned audience, in my system, samadhi and prajna are fundamental. But do not be under the wrong impression that these two are independent of each other, for they are inseparably united and are not two entities. Samadhi is the quintessence or essence of prajna, while prajna is the activity of samadhi or function. At the very moment that we attain prajna, samadhi is therewith, and vice versa. If you understand this principle, you understand the equilibrium of samadhi and prajna. A disciple should not think that there is a distinction between samadhi begets prajna and prajna begets samadhi. To hold such an opinion would imply that there are two characteristics in the Dharma. So this is, you know, getting back to that kind of poking at the causal assumption in practice, that we do all this stuff and then we get the carrot. And it's closer to Dogen's kind of non-dual practice is realization. This is kind of a precursor to that. The very activity of sitting zazen is an expression of enlightenment. So I just wanted to bring that forward. Any questions on that? Yes, Reiju.
Reiju again. One of the things that keeps coming up for me that I keep noticing is, like, who's the other guy who wrote the other verse?
Shen Xu.
He's in the story too.
Yeah.
And this description of the non-dual, like a lot of sutras, it seems like it wraps in on itself, and there it's not really about northern and southern schoolers, sudden and gradual, but it's about both.
Yeah.
And so this, like, description of the samadhi and prajna are not separate. They're happening, they're coexisting together. Like, that's another, like, the non-dualness of it is coming out, and in a way pointing to, like, the non-exist, like, there's also not a separation between the first and the second verses. They are both there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah?
Yeah, that resonates.
So I was curious to clarify. So saying that samadhi, is it the state of concentration that is the essence of mind?
Of prajna.
It's the essence of prajna.
Yeah.
And prajna
is the function of
samadhi. The function of samadhi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that feel like it's making sense, or is it like, oh, they're saying Buddhist words up there?
The second one?
Okay. Let me try again. Yeah, Kelsey.
In my listening to it, it just seems that, you know, as we try to deconstruct enlightenment, and we're trying to put a structure into it, like, say, well, there's a structure here, it feeds this structure here, and so we're sort of creating a mental model of it that it really puts it out of the realm of the experience, because in a way it may be useful to be able to teach the or to relay the experience, but it's not the experience itself. It's almost like the experience is really precognitive. I don't know, prelinguistic in a way. It's in a place that is not either of those things that we're talking about. So it's a very difficult connection to make.
Granted. Yeah. I think like that. Yes, that's definitely true. And I think the point that I'd like to make with this is that we have, like, we have the option to sit tomorrow morning, right? And do we do it or not? And before we've decided, you know, if there's an actual process, if you've been doing it a while, there may not be that process. It may just happen and you find yourself there. But when that decision is happening, often there's a kind of breaking apart the samadhi and the prajna aspects of it. Like, I need to do this so that I can feel better, so that I can see more clearly, so that I can lighten this attachment. And this is the means to that end. And this is kind of like smearing that, like, you know, whatever's keeping those two apart is wiping that away. That's what he's trying to get at here. It's another of those like easy answers that is not gonna hold. And it's not that you have to replace it with something. It's just that you have to know that, like, oh, okay, I'm using it. It's a heuristic. It doesn't really hold, right? Like, there's a, like, let there be that kind of translucence, like jelliness to it. We got time for one more? Oh, okay, yeah, please.
Hi, I'm Bridget. So I feel that in the practice, the way that I like the way of that there is the not calling it meditation, not calling it sitting, but or zazen, but just cultivation.
Yeah.
And there's a different way of that. Yes, of course you can have those moments of eureka, those moments of where you have a complete understanding of the in between behind. You know, you take a step back into it. But then there is the stability of really cultivating your neurological connections to lessen the override of the left brain, and I'm cultivating a different algorithm inside of my synapses.
Yeah.
So that I can't just, like, I'm not just sitting and just to experience different steps of non-duality of in between, because I need it for other practices. Yes, I can have a moment of non-duality and with this cognitive perception. But for me to have an awareness, have a moment of non-duality with, let's say, my dream body, if I'm in dream practice and I really want, I need that stability of my neurological connections to be more right-brained instead of always, you know, I can't have something that's always compartmentalizing, always like so attached to all the imagery is shiny, shiny, shiny. I need that. And I really feel that the cultivation process, it is actually a lot like having an earthquake or a river creating the canyon. When you feel the enormous difference when you're going to have that earthquake, you're like, oh my God, this mind shattering is so different. But is it really so, like, the effects of an earthquake are so devastating? And maybe 6,000 years in the future is going to look the same, but it's very different.
Yeah.
And I think that the cultivation, you just can't really, it's a necessity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just.
Yeah. I agree that there's, that was kind of a speaking to the importance of the gradual, approach, not that it's an either or, but that, and I think, you know, like we recognize that there's something really important about seen really true, really like having a direct understanding of like some deep truths that really shake things up. And having that realization isn't enough. We have to digest it. We have to integrate that over decades and for it to kind of come out cleanly, for it to come out skillfully. Otherwise, it's like it just takes a long time to absorb truth. Yeah. All right. So I'm jumping around a little bit here. This is, we'll get through about the first two-thirds of the sutra in terms of like just hitting highlights. It's not that long. It's like a 50, 60 page thing, depending on the translation. There's a bunch of them here. So it's a fairly easy sutra to like kind of develop a relationship to. Like, it's not like the Avatamsaka, which is like 800 pages. You know, it's approachable. So another pair that he's kind of futzing with. Learned audience, what are jhana and samadhi? Jhana means to be free from all attachments to all outer objects, and samadhi means to attain inner peace. If we are attached to outer objects, our inner mind will be perturbed. When we are free from attachment to all outer objects, the mind will be at peace. Our essence of mind is intrinsically pure, and the reason why we are perturbed is because we allow ourselves to be carried away by the circumstances we are in. One who is able to keep their mind unperturbed, irrespective of circumstances, has attained samadhi. When we are in a position to deal with jhana and to keep our inner mind in samadhi, then we are said to have attained jhana and samadhi. Let us realize this for ourselves at all times. Let us train ourselves, practice it by ourselves, and attain Buddhahood by our own effort. So these two terms are ones that can sometimes be collated. They can be kind of smooshed together. So jhana is states of concentration. Samadhi is a broader term for meditation, and especially like once you're into it, but not necessarily state of concentration. The jhana tends to be more tightly defined. The caveat here is that at different times and in different places, like these two terms had different meanings. So, in the Pali Canon versus in some of the later Mahayana sutras, like these may be used really differently. But Huineng is basically making this distinction between outer attachment and stillness. To be free from attachments to all outer objects is jhana, so that's kind of a cutting off or removing. And to attain inner peace is samadhi, that's more equanimity, right? So one's a little more at the senses, and the other is a little more like at the heart, like how we relate to. Be one way of kind of divvying that up. Questions or comments there? Yes, a ton.
As to how that might relate to prajna and its relationship to samadhi that was discussed just prior?
I don't have anything more to say there. The for the purposes of that previous distinction, jhana and samadhi are going to kind of squished together in terms of relation to prajna.
Okay, so prajna would still be functioning in both of those then? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. As I would say, jhana is kind of a subcase of samadhi, maybe. You know, it's a smaller category within that.
That is interesting how it's just like how there's an outward movement and an inward movement in it.
Yeah.
It's more like an encompassing and then a smaller movement inside and then bigger. Is that what he's talking about?
I think that some people will experience it like that. I've heard that. That's not my way in, but it could be. Yeah. Part of the reason that this shows up in here is that Zen or Chan is basically a translation of jhana. So this is the jhana school of Buddhism. It's the school which relies on meditation as the means of practice. And so this is him kind of like working, like so it was very clear at this time that like this was a Zen school sutra. It has to address the concentration. It has to talk about that. So that's part of what's going on with that piece here. Yeah, Jay?
A question. So samadhi is something that clears away the outer attachment and maybe some other things. But something else has to be done in order to then have prajna or have insight happen. Is that correct? And that extra thing is prajna?
Not according to the previous section. So, like prajna and samadhi, like there's an identity there.
Right? Okay.
Like they're not the same, but they're the same.
Okay.
Like he's saying that, like jhana is this process of focusing, of like guarding the sense gates and like making the concentration one-pointed. That's kind of like cutting off like the external involvements. Samadhi is this. Relinquishment, you know, this non-attachment, that's kind of the equanimity within that concentrated space, and when that's happening, prajna is functioning. So it's like jhana is supportive of samadhi and prajna. It's not a sufficient condition. I wouldn't even say it's a necessary condition, but it's a supportive one.
And so you can have
samadhi without jhana, right? You can have, you can have moments of being like completely non-attached, without being removed from sense experience, external objects.
Mm-hmm. And having achieved this state would be identical to then receiving immediate insight.
Insight is a that's a broad category. And so, like, when I hear that, I kind of wonder if you're meaning, like, kind of like the insight. And yeah. Which guy said, well, no. But like, little insight, sure.
Okay. I guess what I had in my head as a question is, there's this state, and it's not as if you have this state, and then you have to do something else after reaching this state to touch reality or see yeah. things clearly. It's what I hear in the sutras, the act of doing that is the act of seeing things clearly, or I'm that's a question.
Yeah, good. So being in this state of deep non-attachment, samadhi, is, so prajna is happening. That may not, like, prajna may be happening in a way that we, like, can reflect or not, right? It's not something that we're doing. It's kind of the way it is. It's kind of like what is most natural. And so sometimes, like, it kind of refracts off us in a way that, like, we can notice and experience. And it doesn't feel like that's our doing, but we can partake of that, and it feels really good. That's not to say that all the rest of the times that prajna is happening that we don't experience it, like those count, but we're just not having that experience of it. Is that help a little there?
That points me in a direction, or away from a direction.
Okay. Great. Yeah, so that's, like, there should be some question marks right now. That's Welcome to the Platform Sutra. This is kind of what it does. It takes, like, really core, like, important questions, and it kind of squishes them around. And so, like, these are questions that if you have a meditation practice over time and you delve into it with some intensity, these are going to bubble up. You're going to have to, like, have more nuance in how you work with these. And so this is, like, priming that pump. Thanks for exploring. I don't know what's happening next week, but if you look in the newsletter, you'll find out. Oh, Denkoe is next week. Woohoo! I do know what's happening. We'll be doing a lot of meditation. Samadhi and Prajna will be happening.